If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Friday, August the 14th, and you're listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a research fellow here at the Hoover Institution and the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. Joining me via Zoom from somewhere closer to California State Capitol, I'm assuming, is Dan Walters. He's a political columnist for CalMatters, a nonpartisan nonprofit journalism venture committed to explaining how California State Capitol works and why it matters. And if you care about California politics and policy, it is a must read. Those of you who do follow California politics closely already know who Dan Walters is, but for those of you who don't, let me briefly explain his significance. Dan Walters has been a journalist for nearly 60 years now, almost most of that time working for California publications. Dan first set up shop in Sacramento in 1975, the same year a very young Jerry Brown took over for Ronald Reagan as California's governor. Dan Walters would go on to write a daily column on California's political, social, and economic tidings. We have him here today because California suddenly is much more relevant to national politics with the addition of Kamala Harris, the state's junior U.S. senator to the Democratic ticket. Dan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Your biography says that you have written 9,000 columns. That obviously has changed in the time since you've written that. What's the current count, and what are you going to do when you get to 10,000?
Well, yeah, it's above that. I've kind of lost specific count. I think I'm around 9,500 plus, somewhere along that line. Like I say, I've lost it. It'll be 40 years of the column writing in January. Started in January of 1981. So I figure it's getting close to 10,000 anyway. It's up in that vicinity. I was actually thinking about today because my 60th anniversary in professional journalism comes up in less than a month, and I was kind of doing the arithmetic in my mind, and I figured out that I've somehow written probably over 10 million words during that time, which is kind of, I guess I'm in a rut. I guess the only thing you can say is I'm in a rut.
Yes, but you've also achieved something special. I can tell you, if I ever worked for a California governor, you've managed to drive how many governors crazy now in terms of columns? So it started with Jerry, then what got on to Duke Magian, then Wilson, who I worked for, Davis, Schwarzenegger, Jerry. So you're on your seventh governor now, right?
I haven't counted them, but you're probably exactly right.
Okay. Do you have a favorite column that stands out?
Oh, golly. No, I can't even think what I wrote yesterday.
That's probably how you stay busy and stay prolific.
I know. I have written, I don't know. I don't have a favorite column. I try to do what I do as best I can each day. And because of going to work for CalMatters, it's no longer write one day, have it published the next. I have to do it a couple of days in advance. And so by the time the column is actually published or posted, I guess we don't publish anymore, we post. Mm-hmm. I've forgotten about what it was because I've already been written another column by then. And so I have a hard time keeping track of them, basically.
I know all these great newspaper phrases are no more. Go to bed, put to bed, stop the presses.
Oh, listen, I go back to the days of linotype machines and old Underwood cast iron upright typewriters. That's how far I go back. And the composing room and hot metal and all that kind of stuff that you wouldn't even be able to describe it to a young journalist anymore, but that's the way it was one time.
Okay, let's talk about the big political news in California this week, the non-pandemic, non-wildfire news, and that is Kamala Harris joining the Democratic ticket. This is big news for people like you and me, Dan, because we spend a lot of time speculating on California one day being relevant to national politics other than fundraising and who might be the first Californian to get on a ticket and maybe get to the White House, says Ronald Reagan. And here's Kamala Harris now on the ticket and with arguably the insider's track to the 2024 nomination, assuming Biden doesn't run again in 2024. I did a little history, Dan, a little sleuthing, and I found out something interesting. In 1952, Dwight Eisenhower goes searching for a running mate, and he lands on a first-term California senator, 22 years younger than he. That, of course, was Richard Nixon. In 2020, Joe Biden goes scouting for a running mate, and he lands on a first-term California senator, almost 22 years younger than he. That is Kamala Harris. I don't think Kamala Harris is Richard Nixon exactly, but is there something to be said, Dan, about where Nixon stood in California politics in 52 versus where Harris stands in California politics in 2020?
Yeah, I suppose there's something to be said about that. Obviously, that's a kind of an eerie sort of comparison. Obviously, there also, too, that it's a different world. California is a much different place than it was in 1952. I mean, it's like night and day.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was a Republican state. We were a Republican state. And actually, we were a Republican state pretty much into the 1980s. I mean, in gross terms, in terms of presidential politics, anyway. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think there's something to be said there. I'm not sure that Biden sat down and said, wow. Eisenhower did it in 52. I think I'll do the same thing in 2020. I don't think it worked out that way, but it's an interesting coincidence.
Well, it is, because in 52, Nixon is attracted to the Eisenhower campaign for a couple of reasons. Number one, they have to shore up their conservative base, and there is Nixon, who has built a reputation as being fiercely anti-communist. He placates conservatives. And then secondly, he's a young guy. He's only 39 years old, I think, at the time, out of Orange County with a young family as a dog, as we later find out in the Checker speech. So he does have that generational appeal. I guess they were looking for, sort of the soldiers of World War II. Kamala Harris represents what, first and foremost? Diversity. Biracial, like, yeah. Barack Obama. So I'm just curious, Dan, if maybe in some regards, whereas Nixon could have embodied the California 52 in terms of being Orange County and youthful, even though we don't think Nixon is terribly youthful, though, but he was a young man, maybe Harris embodies the California of 2020 in terms of its diversity.
I think that's an apt description. I would even throw another element into it, that Nixon rose to prominence for a rather, really getting a high profile in Washington very quickly. As I recall, and I wasn't alive, well, I was alive then, but I was only 9 years old, as I've read about, the congressional hearings, and he made a name for himself in that.
Right.
And just as Kamala Harris made a name for herself in interrogating Supreme Court justices and other people in Washington, neither had much of a record of substance, of legislative substance, but both had achieved a certain level of public notice, infamy or fame or whatever you want to call it, prior to that. And so I think in both cases, Eisenhower and Biden saw somebody who had kind of instant name recognition in a sense, and as you say, could help shore up, diversify the ticket a little bit and shore it up in certain ways. I suppose in 1952, Eisenhower also saw Nixon as someone who could carry California, help carry right. California for him. I don't think that applies this year. Obviously, Biden's going to win California no matter what. But there's some interesting parallels there. And if it continues on and Kamala Harris does become a viable presidential candidate, that trajectory will also continue as well.
The other parallel that I looked at, Dan, was hers and Barack Obama's. And here it's interesting. Obama has the shorter arc to the White House, to national office. He is first elected to the Illinois State Senate in 1996. He becomes a U.S. Senator in 2004. Then he's president 4 years after that. Kamala, you trace back her. So she becomes San Francisco's DA in 2003. Then she becomes the Attorney General in 2010, Senator in 2016, and like Obama, 4 years later, running for national office. So a 17-year arc. But one thing that I'm curious about here, Dan, maybe you can explain to me, when did sort of the jet stream begin for Kamala Harris? There has been for years now just the talk of her as the female Obama. In other words, she seemed to have enjoyed sort of a celebrity status, both within California and nationally, as just something special. When did you first notice this?
Well, I didn't pay much attention to her until she was running for Attorney General. And it was evident, however, at that time that her main goal was not to necessarily build a record as an official, but get up that ladder as fast as she could. I can recall it became very evident, and people, insiders in the Department of Justice were kind of blabbing about this a lot, that from the onset, people around her in the Department of Justice were told, your main job is to promote Kamala Harris's career. And she's going places and you better get on it and you can ride along with her. And so it was always a kind of a naked ambition sort of thing. But she also can be quite charming in many respects, particularly in the public realm. She has a good sense of her audiences and how to appeal to them. And of course, her own background of being half black and half Southeast Asian or Indian is, it hits a lot of buttons, plus being female. I mean, she's got three buttons right there. And she was obviously a very powerful political commodity from day one. You might recall Obama got himself in a little bit of trouble by praising her beauty when she was Attorney General. Yes. Boy, that wouldn't fly today, would it?
I think he used the word hot, didn't he?
He could get impeached for that if he said it today.
Yes,
it would. So, but I mean, this is the thing. It was evident from day one, virtually, that she was on a ladder, and she was going to get up that ladder as quickly as she possibly could, and she has succeeded. She has climbed that ladder, and now is, as they say, almost a heartbeat away from the presidency.
Yeah, Dan, we sit here in 2020, and I'm looking back over the last 10 years, and I see two big turning points in California politics. One is the election of 2010, where she, if you go back and look at the numbers in 2010, she has a really close race against Steve Cooley, who is
very close, yeah,
the DA. And if you crunch the numbers, actually, she gets in that office because he does poorly in Los Angeles County. He does poorly in Los Angeles County because Meg Whitman, the Republican gubernatorial candidate, is just a disaster down there, and he gets dragged down with her. So she could have easily lost that race, Dan. Now, maybe she would have bounced back in 2014 and maybe then jumped into the Senate in 2016. Maybe she would end up on the same track, but maybe not if she loses that race. Maybe she loses.
Well, I agree. I don't think that she would have. That was a very important rung on her ladder. And you're right. It was an extremely close race, and probably under other circumstances, she would have probably lost it. And you're right. Meg Whitman did. And it also illustrates another thing that I've hammered at a few times, that the big turning point in California's politics, the real turning point, moved to being a blue state from at least a purple state in the mid-1990s, was the transformation of Los Angeles County from a neutral venue, basically neutral, to one that leaned blue, leaned Democratic very strongly in the aftermath of the collapse of the aerospace industry and the flight out of Southern California by aerospace workers and their families, and the influx of immigrants, completely transformed the politics of Los Angeles County in an astonishingly short period of time, just a very few years. And when it tilted Los Angeles County with 25% of the population of California, it tilted the entire state.
And if you go back,
I actually wrote a chapter of a book about exactly that one time.
Yeah,
it's very evident. If you look at the data and you look at how LA was leaning before and how LA leaned after the great aerospace meltdown, it's very dramatic.
I try to explain this to Republican audiences that it's very simple. If you look at Los Angeles County, which, as you mentioned, is 25% of the voting population, I think Meg Whitman, Dan, got about 32% of the vote in LA County in that election. And just do the math. You cannot make up the vote statewide if you start with 32%, and it kills the ticket. And that's how someone like Steve Cooley, who was of Los Angeles, ends up losing. But so I look at the 2010 election as a crossroad, Dan, and then the second one I look at is 2016. Now, this is maybe you know more about the story than I do, but we know that Kamala Harris and Gavin Newsom, now our governor, he's also elected in 2010 as lieutenant governor. They come to a crossroads of sorts, and the crossroads is that there are two seats becoming empty, becoming available. The governor's office is available in 2018 because Jerry Brown is term limited. And now the U.S. Senate seat held by Barbara Boxer is available. And I think to the outside audience, you need to understand that these are lifetime appointments. It's almost like becoming a Supreme Court justice now, California Senate seat. I worked for Pete Wilson, Dan. He was the last elected Republican senator in California, and he held the so-called jinx seat. And he won that office in 1982, and he ran for re-election with a very healthy amount of paranoia, knowing it was a jinx seat. He would have to escape Washington on Thursday nights, catch the last plane back to California from Dulles Airport. No direct flights, Reagan National then, so it was an ordeal to get back here. And he had to be on the ground campaigning constantly to make sure that he held that seat. But Dianne Feinstein is coming up on 30 years in her seat. She'll be 30 years in 2022. I assume, Dan, that Barbara Boxer had run for re-election in 2016. She would have probably breezed in. She'd still be there right now. So if Kamala loses, she still has that seat for life. She wants to. So Democrats, you know, are going to line up. Let's get to that in a minute. But Newsom and Harris have to decide which office to go for. It gets interesting because they share a political consultant. But take us a bit through the 2016 decision-making and what you think Newsom and Harris were looking at the time.
I think you said it right. Remember, there's a common denominator, too, not only the same campaign consultant, but Willie Brown, who fostered both of their careers.
Yes.
And got them launched in San Francisco onto whatever careers they have. That's where it all started. Mm-hmm. I think it in a way met their own personal ego situation. Both like to talk, right? Both like to orate.
Yes.
But I think Newsom also had an interest in governance that she didn't have. And he's a kind of a great theoretician of government and how it should work and everything. So I think he, in a way, yes, there were some political ambitions in it, but I also think that the offices suited each of them better. Of course, right. Newsom may be regretting that decision now under what's going on, but I think at the time, I think it's kind of suited them better. Maybe something, the historic connections between the Newsom and the Brown families may have had something to do with that. Remember, Newsom wanted to run for governor in 2010.
Briefly tried it, yeah.
And got kind of pushed aside by Uncle Jerry, and because he really is kind of his uncle, you know. And
they have an interesting relationship, Dan. I asked Newsom this one time about just why is Jerry rough on you? Because, you know, Brown would take swipes at him as lieutenant governor. And he said, he's interesting, Dan. He said, because every time he looks at me, he sees a little boy wearing a baseball cap. In other words, Newsom thinks that in Brown's mind that Newsom is forever a kid. So,
when Newsom was inaugurated in January of last year, I wrote a column about the interconnections of the Getty, Pelosi, Brown, and Newsom families, and how deeply they are connected by politics, by marriage, by economics, by finances. And it goes back to Pat Brown and Gavin Newsom's grandfather back in the 1930s and on and on and on. And Newsom's father, who was one of Jerry Brown's closest friends and so forth. And so in a way, going for the governorship was in the family tradition too, because of Pat Brown and Jerry Brown. I mean, it was kind of where they kind of gravitated to, whereas Kamala Harris wasn't interested in government.
Right.
Maybe she'll have some interest in government as vice president. I don't know. Although you don't have to have that interest to be vice president.
No, you don't.
She wanted to go, I think, national from day one. Mm-hmm. And I think it just kind of suited the two of them to go the direction they went. You mentioned Dianne Feinstein. I think that's highly likely she will not be running for re-election.
Well, let's see. She just turned 87 in June, I believe. So we're not South Carolina. She's not Strom Thurmond. So yeah, I'd assume she'd be stepping down in 2024.
Yeah, and I think there's no secret that she really didn't want to run in 2018 again, but was talked into it.
Yeah.
And because the Democratic hierarchy feared that if she didn't run, there would be this enormous shootout in California, would soak up so much money that it wouldn't be available for other races. And so she kind of reluctantly agreed to do so. But so, I mean, then that opens up the thing, would Gavin Newsom run for that Senate seat? It's even possible that if the Democrats don't take control of the Senate this year, that she might even quit early. I think that's a possibility. There's a lot of seats in the game of musical chairs.
I know, and I'm going to get to that in a minute, but you mentioned Willie Brown, Dan. This raises the question of what is kind of inbounds and out of bounds we're talking about with Kamala Harris. You may have seen that a couple of Democratic insiders back in Washington sent out a memo to journalists saying that basically don't go places with her. And I think that was probably a veiled reference to the Willie Brown relationship, but maybe it's worth you explaining a little bit what her relationship is with him. And why don't you also explain as a journalist how you think the media can really kind of explain this properly?
Well, anybody who knows Willie knows that he plays the field, shall we say.
Right. He's married still, but it's an open
marriage. Oh yeah. The marriage of convenience has been gone on for 5 decades or something like that. And there, the landscape of San Francisco is littered not with the carcasses, but with the bodies of Willie Brown's ex-girlfriends. And she was one of them. Mm-hmm. At the time, there was no question that she was one of his girlfriends in this kind of, as he tripped through the lovelies of San Francisco. And, but Willie always takes care of his girlfriends, even ex-girlfriends, with jobs and help and advice and that sort of thing. And I think that she would not have gone anywhere politically without Willie Brown. She moved to San Francisco specifically from Oakland, specifically to get into have a political career with Willie Brown's advice. Mm-hmm. And without him, she would have been nobody. Without Willie, would Gavin Newsom probably would have a better chance of being politically successful without Willie Brown. But certainly Willie gave him that first big step up. Right. Get him on the ladder, on the bottom rung of the ladder. And you cannot overestimate the influence of Willie Brown in San Francisco politics, whether it's Nancy Pelosi or Kamala Harris or Gavin Newsom or Dianne Feinstein, for that matter. I mean, he is a kind of a kingmaker. He's the man. He's the power.
And well, Willie is not in the California Hall of Fame, which drives me crazy. I write a column each year, Dan, just going off of this.
Oh, obviously he should be there, yeah.
Yeah, but he's not in it. I don't understand why he is not in it.
I think it's not in it because he has a certain reputation for being kind of shifty, I guess is the word, and his public persona is not as benevolent as his persona in San Francisco and among political insiders. I mean, he comes across as kind of a fixer. Mm-hmm. And whether it's a political fixer or financial fixer or whatever, that's the way he comes across. And he loves that role. He loves making deals. That's Willie's great love of life, is making deals.
Right.
And so he should be in the Hall of Fame. He absolutely should be. He should have been one of the first people to go into the Hall of Fame, for that matter. So it's strange. But to those in politics, I mean, he's central to everything in San Francisco politics and to a great degree in Capitol politics. Not in Southern California politics, just the opposite there. But he's central to everything, and he's central to both of the careers of both of our current leading stars, Gavin Newsom and Kamala Harris.
So Willie is Bay Area. Dianne Feinstein is San Francisco. Gavin Newsom, Bay Area, though he lives in Sacramento now because of the job. Kamala Harris, Bay Area, though she lives in Brentwood now with her husband. When did the state become so top-heavy politically, Dan, in terms of San Francisco running things?
Forever.
Forever.
Go back.
Reagan was from Southern California, Pete Wilson, Duke Machen. You've had some Southern California.
Governors can come from someplace else, but the real power in the legislature particularly has always been San Francisco.
But why is that? Because the population center is down south.
Well, because politics is a blood sport in San Francisco. It's a full-time occupation, sport, whatever. Whereas in Southern California, it's kind of, who cares? Let's go to the beach. That's not that focus and that crucible that San Francisco is when it comes to politics. And I think that goes back to even the gold rush days and in the days, the early part of the 20th century. San Francisco has always had a disproportionately heavy presence in California's politics, even though it doesn't have the population numbers that would imply. And it's got a lot of money there. There's a, and that, that's a lot of it too. That you can raise money in San Francisco very easily because there are a lot of very wealthy people in the Bay Area. Even before Silicon Valley, that was true. That was San Francisco was California's banking center for many, many decades. It was just a big powerhouse, whereas LA was just kind of laid back. LA lacks focus.
Right.
San Francisco does not lack focus. Everybody knows San Francisco centered Bay Area is a very focused, cogent thing. Whereas in Southern California, they just don't have that same kind of thing. I actually wrote a long piece about that, the fact, why does San Francisco dominate Los Angeles economically? It was about economically. And think about that. Mm-hmm. It's the data on that are just overwhelming about where is the money. The money is in the San Francisco Bay Area. San Francisco Bay Area economy, up until this recent pandemic at least, propped up the entire state.
Right.
Los Angeles is a basket case. It has the highest poverty of any county in California. It has very low incomes. It is a very, very troubled place, whereas San Francisco has cogency and it has organization and has a lot of smart people and a lot of money, and that what's how they dominate things.
Now, if Kamala Harris becomes a vice president, Dan, then Gavin Newsom gets to pick her successor. People seem to think that she picks her successor. She may have recommendations, but it's a governor's call. And
absolutely,
Pete Wilson went through this in 1991, and I think this is really going to be fascinating to watch if it happens, because Gavin Newsom has the same challenge as Joe Biden did, if you will, Dan, and that he's going to have to engage in identity politics, and he's going to have to find somebody who checks a lot of boxes. For example, this is a seat that's been held by women exclusively since 1992. So to break the gender train would be a very difficult thing for Newsom to do. He will face pressures to pick a Latino, maybe an Asian American, African American, for obvious reasons. Good luck finding that person who suits all those boxes. But you're watching this right now. I know this is very early speculation. We're still months away from the election, even months after that for the replacement. But you see, you hear names, you hear Karen Bass, you hear Javier Becerra. Who would be on the Dan Walter shortlist of players in this?
Well, I think Gavin Newsom, first of all, is not bound to select a woman because Dianne Feinstein is still there.
Okay.
So I think that he has a little leeway in that. But I do think there is going to be tremendous pressure to name a Latino, the first Latino senator from California.
I mean, he couldn't pick a white Caucasian male like Adam Schiff, could he?
Could he? Oh, yeah, he could, but I don't think he will. I think it almost certainly has to be Latino. Mm-hmm. I don't think he can write off the state's largest single ethnic group. And that then said, well, who? Well, I think that the two leading contenders for that, I do believe, are Javier Becerra, the Attorney General, and Alex Padilla, the
Secretary
of State, who's very close to Newsom, by the way, personally. Okay. And I think they would be on the top of my list. And I've already said on Twitter, I think Becerra has the edge. And I tell you why I think he has the edge, because lesser true of Padilla is by selecting Becerra, he also gets to name a new attorney general. So it's a twofer.
Yeah.
Now, he would also get to name a Secretary of State, but who cares, right? But the Attorney General is a very, very powerful it's probably second only to the governorship in real power in California. Yes. And he would be able to select somebody for Attorney General. So whoever he doesn't pick for the Senate could presumably be Attorney General if they're, of course, they're a lawyer. So I think that's kind of why I think Becerra has the inside track. But just remember, Becerra has carried the cudgel for Newsom against the White House now for a year and a half. He's the guy who sued
Newsom seven ways to sundown.
Yeah, what, 70 times or 80 times? Heck, I've lost count on that.
He also comes in very handy when it comes to the offering of titles and summaries for ballot initiatives.
Does too. That's certainly true. Yes. So I don't know. I kind of tend to put Becerra at the top of the list with Alex Padilla on number two. And then if you round out the top others, I would put Karen Bass in there. I see that Antonio Villaraigosa is trying to make a late run. Good luck on that, Antonio. I think your yesterday's news.
He also once campaigned to get in the Obama cabinet.
I mean, he's desperate for a job. I think I would put Karen Bass in there because of her recent. She was very little known up until recently, but now she's got a national.
Here's a thought. Why doesn't Newsom appoint himself? Because he's discovered the past few months.
It's not fun being
governor of California right now.
Okay, let's game this out. Let's assume that Gavin Newsom wants to be president of the United States, which is a pretty good assumption, I think. How does that work? Well, if Biden and Kamala Harris are elected, he's now frozen out for 2024.
Right.
Run for president of the United States more than likely, almost certainly. So how does he extend his career? One way would be to run for Dianne Feinstein's Senate seat that year. One way would be to cross his fingers and hope that Trump gets elected, I guess. and another way would be to make a deal with the lieutenant governor to make her the first woman governor of California. And go to the Senate himself and play the long game. I mean, he goes to the Senate as still a relatively young politician. He could hang around then and run for president in 2028 or something like that. So yeah, I think though that to boil it down, Newsom's own career aspirations will be part of the equation in who he appoints to that Senate seat, mm-hmm. including the possibility that he could appoint himself or have Eleni appoint him after resigning, I think. And that's happened before, as we know. It's happened in other states. I don't think it's ever happened in California. The closest we came to it was in 1958 when Bill Nolan and Goody Knight tried to swap seats.
Right.
To the detriment of both, obviously. That was a real boneheaded move. Driven by Nolan's idea that he wanted to be president of the United States and the best place to be best platform to be governor of California rather than U.S. senator, but that's another story. So I think that color, that Gavin Newsom's own career ambitions, his own timeline, his own plotting out ahead as to what's the next move on my career, that plays into it. And you can't discount the fact that right now his governorship is a mess.
Yes.
His popularity is declining. He has obviously made some serious errors in handling COVID. The state's economy is in the tank, the worst since the Great Depression, and he's inevitably going to be held somewhat responsible for that. And so maybe you just say, hell, being governor of California is really tough. Maybe I would like to go to the Senate, and so all I have to do in the Senate is make speeches. I don't have to actually do anything. So yeah, I don't know. I think it's all in the mix somewhere. Yeah.
It sounds like you have a column in your head now with this, but it's funny. So we started this podcast talking about Kamala Harris being Richard Nixon. Now we've just turned Gavin Newsom into Dick Cheney. I made a search. I've come to the conclusion I'm the best pick.
Yeah, I think Gavin Newsom's fully capable of doing that.
I think one challenge for Newsom, Dan, it's almost a Donald Trump-like challenge in this regard. Donald Trump was not elected to do this situation now to handle a real honest to God horrible crisis. He is essentially elected in many regards as a good time president, if you will. You know, let the economy go along and just, you know, he won't do any harm and all will be fine. And I would argue that Newsom is in regards kind of the same way. And I think you've written about this too, that this is a guy who's passed, really, he's not faced many crises, a personal political one, but in terms of public policy before becoming governor, he's never kind of been tested like this. And so now he has to be tested, and maybe suddenly the long-winded explanations, the technocratic, the Gavin speak, as we call it. I have friends who we do calls every day. We talk about the word salad, as we call it, as daily press conferences, which go on forever and ever and ever. This is not a good look for him. It's not a good situation for him.
No, it's not a good situation for him. And I do think he's kind of wearing out his welcome on those podcasts. He just can't help himself. He should be up there and speak for 5 minutes, let the health people take over and take some questions. Instead, he goes on for 45 minutes. I liken it to a public television fundraising break. You know, they say that he says the same thing over and over and over and over and over again, like we're all idiots and we didn't get it the first time. And then suddenly he's out of time and can't take any questions, or he takes up about 3 questions and goodbye. Mm-hmm. See you next time. I tell you, the press corps has gotten very, very sour on the idea that they get a question in, maybe no follow-up, no nothing. It's the questioning, such as it is getting tougher and tougher and tougher, because the man has made some really serious mistakes. There's no question about that.
What kind of press corps is there, though, in Sacramento, Dan? Because I want to get to this. So the Capital Weekly, it's a publication in Sacramento. They do each year a top 100 list, and we were talking about this before we came on the air. You look at it, right, and you look at like the first 15 to 20 picks, and it's just loaded with either Newsom appointees or people in the executive branch of government, which kind of maybe shows which branch lords over the other, Dan. And then you look at it for lobbyists. You see plenty of lobbyists and special interest people, consultants, and so forth. And I went looking through it for journalists, Dan, and there are three journalists out of the 100, and they occupy spots number 74, 85, and number 100, number 100 being a colleague of yours at CalMatters. What does this say about the state of journalism in Sacramento?
Well, the state of journalism in Sacramento is very troubled. As you know, at least as much as I do, the newspaper industry is in the tank. McClatchy's just gone through bankruptcy. It's a shadow of its former self. The Los Angeles Times has a rich owner, but that rich owner seems to be getting a little not so happy about that, the drain on his personal wealth, and they're cutting back now. And the press corps of in Capital Press Corps, which one time was maybe 75 to 100, is down to, you know, a couple of dozen, basically two, three dozen at the most. And frankly, that CalMatters, my employer, is about half of it, at least half of it.
Right.
And we've been growing while others have been shrinking, fortunately, and still are growing. Ironically, we were supposed to move into new quarters, would finally get us all together. On the weekend we made the physical move was the weekend they say, go home and don't come back when we tell you so. And so we've not ever gotten to our new offices.
Right now, virtually.
But maybe we are the future of political news in California.
But, you know, I raise this not to run Governor Newsom to the ground, Dan, but because when you look at various problems that he's encountered, look, it's revealed that the state of California cannot count COVID cases. It has a backlog of 300,000 cases. The state can't write unemployment checks. This raises just fundamental questions of state technology, which you've written about, and just state operations. It's the kind of stuff that begs investigative journalism, especially when you have a $200 billion enterprise that is state government, which is about the same annual operation budget as Apple. But yet we don't seem to have enough teeth in journalism in California to really explore these things.
Well, in defense, CalMatters does that. And right. Actually, the LA Times and the Sacramento Bee, as battered as it has been, have done some very, very good investigative stuff. For example, LA Times just the other day had a long, long, long story about how a bridge on the bullet train, speaking of disasters, the bullet train bridge situation was up. The bridge was completely screwed up. They have to basically go back and rebuild it. It was very expensive. It delays and everything. I think the real question, and it didn't start with Gavin Newsom. The real question about state government these days is, can it do anything right? Is it competent? Well, DMV, EDD, the bullet train, all these computer projects that are kind of half-baked and or dysfunctional,
right,
tell us that we have a kind of a crisis of competence, which happens to be the title of my column that will be posted on Monday. We do have this kind of crisis of competence. And Newsom didn't start it, but Newsom said, I'm the guy who can fix all these things. I'm the guy who wrote a book about transforming government in the new age, and I can make all this stuff work. So he sends out these strike teams, and he does this, and he appoints this commission and that task force and all this kind of stuff. But the problems pervade. And so he's kind of being hoisted on his own petard in the sense that he promised a new wave of competence, and we haven't seen it yet. And in fact, we've seen a new wave of incompetence on things that you mentioned, the contracts for masks, the contracts for ventilators, the miscounting of cases, the breakdown of the computer system, all this stuff. So he's got a real problem. He's got now, having raised the promise level, he's going to have a hard time meeting that. And I tend to think that if things continue along their present path in Sacramento, that were the Republicans to come up with a halfway decent candidate, they might actually have a chance. Because if this pandemic continues and if the recession continues on for a couple more years, there might be a time for a, well, not exactly a Trump-like revolution, but some sort of a revolt against Sacramento in general. People have to take it out on somebody, and that might be who takes it out.
I was curious if you thought any kind of revolt like a Prop 13, you know, pitchfork rebellion, but this might be a fun time, Dan, to tell the audience the answer to the trivia question of the last first-term governor to be kicked out of office.
The last first-term governor to be kicked out of office.
1942.
Yeah.
Colbert Olson. What stands out about Colbert Olson?
He was kicked out of office after one term by Earl Warren.
Earl Warren, right.
No, he's gone on to win three terms.
Yeah, Olson's an interesting story because he's a Democrat, which is kind of a long time ago. This is an odd fit in California. He'd been electing Republicans for the first half of the century. He comes out in 1938, and in 1942, California is on a wartime footing. But Olson's also kind of an odd duck. He's an atheist.
Yeah, he was kind of a radical of his day, as I recall.
Well, he pardoned a socialist. It was one of the first things he did in office. He pardoned a socialist bomber. But I think he got into trouble, Dan, when he took the oath of office and wouldn't say the words, "So help me God." He said words to the effect that, "I don't see God bailing me out of trouble." So that is now not a good way to start things off.
There are a lot of anomalies. And when you asked the question, I almost said Gray Davis, but you had the caveat of the first-term governor.
No, everybody jumps on Davis. They think that, or they think Pat Brown for some reason. He's running for a third term. I bring this up, Dan, because first-term governors, I worked for one who was down by 23 points at one point, and he ended up winning by 15 points. It's a pretty strong office to get reelected in, so to say that Newsom could struggle, and I think Davis was reelected by about 7 points, but it was pretty underwhelming.
Davis was paper thin. It was like 500,000 votes is all it was.
It was not a very, it's not exactly.
He only won because he won in Los Angeles County, as a matter of
right.
fact.
Right. But to say that Newsom could be vulnerable, yeah, it's two things. It's number one, really, if he's that weak of a governor by then. But secondly, you hit on the key thing. Could the Republicans ever get their act together in California and put forward somebody who could be competitive?
I think it would have to be some sort of a fusion candidate to have a take. And I'm not saying it's going to happen, but this pandemic and the recession it spawned is one of the, I think, history-altering events, not only for the country, but particularly for California. Mm-hmm. And it is so damaging to the economy and particularly drives a wider wedge between the haves and the have-nots in this state. You might see a pitchfork revolt of sorts from the poor. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a possibility. And there's all sorts of stuff kicking around. I mean, how could we possibly think of take seriously the proposals in the legislature to borrow $100 billion or to raise taxes on the rich again or to put on a wealth tax? I mean, these are strange times we're living in. And Gavin Newsom, like I say, this has only been going on for, 6 months now, 5 months? Mm-hmm. What if it goes on for 2 years? What if we have high double digit unemployment for 2 years? I wouldn't want to be governor in that set of circumstances because then all the low hanging fruit of dealing with it would have been eaten. And then you're into the real soup. Then you have to really make serious budget cuts. Then you have to entertain things like cutting pensions or, I mean, who knows? Everybody in Sacramento has their fingers crossed and say, yes, we're a nation state and we're so powerful, but will you please send us $14 billion to prop up our budget?
I was just about to say Governor Newsom or Governor Kounalakis, whoever's the governor, calls up Vice President Harris and says, please send us $20 billion. Why not?
Why not? And to kind of close the circle in a way, we started out talking about Kamala Harris and her going on the ticket. Is she really an asset to Biden in some of those swing states? And you know where those swing states are. They're in the upper Midwest and, right. and Pennsylvania and Florida and maybe Arizona. Does having a Californian on the ticket help you in those places? I don't know.
Well, that's kind of my final question to you, Dan. It's when you talk about Kamala Harris, are we really talking about California, or are we just kind of talking about a larger concept? Because we didn't talk about Illinois and we talked about Barack Obama. So isn't that maybe part of the Biden calculation that because Kamala has this certain coolness to her because she, yes, because she is biracial like Obama, but also because she has a certain style, she just kind of makes it look easy, the media swoon over her, that you just, California doesn't become a factor here.
I think that you will see attacks on the Democratic ticket in these key states along the lines is, look at all this crazy stuff in California. Look at what they're doing in California, and just tick off four or five big crazy things in California. This is what they want to bring to you in Michigan and Wisconsin and Ohio. Do you want this? This is what you get. And I think California will be on trial in this campaign.
You really think it will be?
I mean, that's an obvious sort of ploy that if I were in the Trump White House, I would say, yes, let's just ring, let's hang California around the neck of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris.
I think that's an interesting idea because going after her, and this is why I brought up the Willie Brown question, going after her is difficult. Because it'll seem personal, it'll seem sexist in some way, it'll seem just too much. But you just associate her with California, Nancy Pelosi, even Gavin Newsom if you want to, and make her defend that.
Yeah, the cabal, the San Francisco cabal. I mean, this has been a line in Republican attack pieces for a long time. San Francisco Democrat, right? Well, this will be the ultimate test of that line of thing. And you know, and there are things in California that completely turn off people in the rest of the United States. Mm-hmm. And if you distill those down to a 30-second spot, show signs, show rioting, or show whatever in California, show all those pictures of all those homeless people on the streets of San Francisco, on the streets of LA, and all this stuff, you could make a pretty powerful argument about that. This is what they want the rest of the country to be like. And, you know, I would be surprised if we don't see that kind of a campaign coming up this fall.
You know, Dan, when we conclude this, I'm going to go do some homework and see what states have quarantine rules in effect where, because if Wisconsin has a quarantine rule for 14 days, she can't go back to California necessarily. It's kind of complicated when you start thinking about this, but no, I mean, I'm joking about this, but this does raise a point though, because she has been in the Senate for the last 4 years. She is in some respects had the luxury of being 2,500 miles away from what goes on in Sacramento. So I guess you could try to tie her to those things by default, but she has not been there casting votes.
No, she hasn't been casting votes, but a media campaign doesn't have to get into that level of
association.
All you do is show you're running against California is what you're doing. You're not running against her or Biden. You're running against California.
Okay, so you don't think she takes the bulls by the horns and praises the big blue progressive paradise that is the West Coast?
Well, as you know, it's a troubled paradise at best. And it will be a very interesting experience to see her. She did not do well when she was running on her own.
No, she was the third in and the third out.
And she it was kind of her ambition and lack of substance that kind of got to her. That could be a help in this case, because she's harder to pin down as, you know, her line of attack. But I don't think you have to attack her. I think you just attack California. I think if I were the White House, that's why I'd say we're going to hang California around their necks.
All right, final question, Dan. I sure appreciate your time here. I want you to channel your inner Kevin Starr here, the late California historian, and just kind of briefly explain the California of 2020 with the senator running for national office, but also dealing with the pandemic. Is there any way to do a parallel to the Depression era California or in early California, or is this a unique set of circumstances?
Well, there are obvious parallels to the Great Depression, although we don't have a whole bunch of people trekking across the country to come here, just the opposite these days. I think in many ways this is a unique thing. To have a pandemic and a very severe recession all at the same time, and maybe you know, an earthquake and then throw in a couple of fires and stuff like this. This is a very trying period in California. This really is a test of our resiliency. Nobody knows where the economy is going. If we get a plateau recovery where it just kind of lingers on, this we could see some serious erosion in California in terms of people just saying, I'm tired of this place, I want to get out. I mean, you hear anecdotal stuff about that, but we haven't seen mass migration yet, even though we lose more people to other states than we get. But I think this is one of those defining periods where we'll find out what California is made of, whether we do have resiliency, whether the much vaunted California dream is still alive, or we have shifted into some sort of a decline mode. Our greatest peril, it seems to me, is for the state to become Los Angeles, which is so troubled. It's all beyond belief how troubled Los Angeles is.
Yes.
With their poverty levels and housing crisis and homelessness and moribund economy and so forth. That's our danger. If Los Angeles is the harbinger of California's future, we're in deep, deep trouble.
Yeah, I just literally got a text a moment ago, Dan, from a friend of mine who lives down in Los Angeles asking, would you please write a column on asking why the mayor of Los Angeles was on Joe Biden's vice presidential search committee? In other words, doesn't he have better uses of his time?
Well, it's probably true, but, you know, it's one of those things politicians do, right? They stroke each other.
He might be another guy looking to escape.
And another guy who would love to have a Senate seat, I suspect.
Maybe Secretary of HUD or something like that. So, hey, Dan Walters, I enjoyed the conversation.
All right. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy choices confronting America's 45th president, and in this case, the politics of California. You can find the Hoover Institution online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for the Hoover Daily Report. It sends the best work of the Hoover Fellowship straight to your inbox weekdays. You can find the Hoover Institution on Facebook and on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Dan Walters is on Twitter, brave man that he is. His Twitter handle is @DanCalMatters. That's @Dan, D-A-N, CalMatters spelled C-A-L-M-A-T-T-E-R-S. And his fine publication is CalMatters, as I mentioned. The website for that is www.calmatters.org. Dan, anything else I need to plug?
No, you've plugged all the holes.
Very good. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.